This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hey, my name is Aaron, 29, and I live in a wee village just south of Glasgow. I've been sober curious for a couple of years now, regularly listening to the podcast while stuck in the drinking hamster wheel. I would class myself as a middle-aged drinker, starting from a young age to drinking 2 pints of Guinness and a bottle of wine every night as standard, ramping it up at the weekends. I had my last drink on the 31st of December, 22, kicking off the new year with dry January. 2 weeks in, I took the plunge and decided to join the community. It was the best decision I made. I'm now 100 days sober and looking forward to smashing the big 365. I have made friends for life in the community who are always there if I need support and to help celebrate milestones. Previous failed attempts at sobriety were always on my own. Connection is key. If you're listening to this podcast and you're sober curious or attempting this on your own, I encourage you to make that leap and join us. You won't regret it.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to Over the Influence. It is fabulous to have you listening. If you are maybe joining us for the first time and thinking, who's this banging on about sobriety? A quick reintroduction. Again. How many times have I done it now? I think we're talking hundreds.
Quite a few.
You know what? And I'll never stop, Ben. And I'll never stop. Try stopping me.
No.
My name is Sharon Hartley. Everybody calls me Shaz, based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. I can now officially say that I am over 5 flipping years alcohol free. It is the best thing I have ever done for many, many, many reasons. And if you want to know what those reasons are, just go back to episode 1 and start from the beginning. I never meant to become sober. I didn't want to stop drinking. But I did know that I needed to change my relationship with alcohol, and I thought, well, let's take a boring break and then get fully back on it. It never happened. The break was ace. I fell in love with sobriety, and here I am now, week in, week out, banging on about it with, well, he used to be called Background Ben. Lol, how retro is that?
I now have been given a microphone. Yes, hello, my name is Ben. I'm 35. I live in Liverpool. I am husband to Jem, dad to baby Leo, stepdad to Alfie and Millie. And I am 3 years and a few months alcohol free. And you know what, Shaz? I was thinking about exactly this on the way back up from our trip to Penny Fan in South Wales. We climbed South Wales's highest mountain with a load of OTI members on Saturday. I'd had a really busy week at work. You know, I'd done 2 days in Manchester, back to Liverpool, back over to Manchester, back to Liverpool on that Friday night, and then drove 4.5 hours down to Merthyr Tydfil in South Wales. We got up at 6 o'clock the next morning, climbed the flipping mountain.
Hang on, you got lost as per flipping usual. Was late.
I got lost. Yeah, I was. But got there in the end, which is the important part. Then we climbed a mountain and I got back in the car and drove 4.5 hours back to Liverpool. None of that would have happened if I'd not removed alcohol 3 and a bit years ago. In fact, climbing mountains was a thing that I always talked about. Oh, when I was a kid, I used to climb mountains all the time. I'm going to start doing that again. And I talk about that in the pub. That's just one small thing, but it's a huge thing for my life now. I love getting outside. I haven't done it for a while, Shaz, especially with you, because we've had a busy summer. But it was great to be on the side of a mountain with a load of people who are alcohol-free, all for different reasons, all different backgrounds. Wasn't it just a fabulous day?
You know what? It was ace. And we're doing it again. We're having a really, really long-winded intro, but we will come to our guest in just one tick, very quickly.
Yep.
The highlight for me, apart from all of it, on that weekend, Ben, was just sitting on the edge of the summit there, looking over the view with you, with your last-minute shop-bought garage butty and me with my smelly eggy baps. And it was a beautiful moment, wasn't it?
Right, let's not talk about smelly eggy baps because we've got to put our posh voices on, Sharon.
Yes, we do.
It's the first time that we've ever been joined by a member of Parliament.
It's going to be a bit of a different episode, I think, it's fair to say this week. As you know, if you're a regular listener to Over the Influence, we bang on about sobriety and we share people's stories of recovery, of their AF adventures, of their big milestones. But quite often with somebody's story or somebody's decision to remove alcohol, it's not always good news, and it's not always a positive story to share. And it is a slightly different episode this week because we're joined on the podcast by Sarah Brickcliffe, MP for Conservative MP for Hindburn and Haslingden in my neck of the woods in Lancashire. And today you're going to hear a really painful and personal story from Sarah about how you've been impacted, Sarah, over the years. And you're going to talk about your mum, who you lost a few years ago now. So first of all, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We massively appreciate it.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to be with you both. And the main thing for me is if my story can help others, then I've done what I need to do with telling my story. And that was always a fear for me because I never really felt that I was in a position where I wanted to be able to open up about it. I never felt ready. But actually, I am in a position of power. I can change things. So my story could help a lot of other people. So that is why. The reason that I gave the national interview in the first place and the reason that, again, Sharon, I'm happy to come on to the show today as well.
Thank you. We really, really appreciate it. When did you decide, Sarah, that you were ready to talk about it?
I didn't, in a sense. I knew I had to at some point. I knew that there were others that suffered the way that I suffered, seeing my mum in the way that she was. But I never really decided that I was ready. It was kind of, I gave myself a push, in a sense, and said to myself that, looking at the polling now, I might not be a member of parliament for much longer, but I could make the change that's necessary for the people that have suffered in the same way that I've suffered. So I never felt ready, but it felt like something I had to do. And I'll be honest, when I did the GB News interview, I didn't expect myself to open up as much as I did, but then all of the memories just came back. And the amount of emails, messages, etc., that I got to say, thank you so much. I've never really heard somebody speak about it in such a candid way. And never from a politician as well. Because everybody looks at politicians as the people that are out of this world. They don't know who they are. They don't realise that actually every politician has a backstory as well. They've got a childhood, etc. And one of my aims is to try and change something that makes it better for other people. And regardless of political colours, I do believe that every politician comes in to do that. And they just have different ways of achieving it.
We're going to talk about what life was like for you growing up and about when you lost your lovely mum, Gabrielle, in 2004. You were only 9 years old. You were a little girl. Take us back, sorry, if you don't mind, and share your memories of what it was like for you growing up and memories of your mum.
Yeah, so, and I said this previously, my mum was the most wonderful woman that you would ever meet. And everybody who I met, even now, I have people coming up to me in the streets in Hindburn and they say, you look just like your mum, because they met her, they knew her. But everybody always says to me, and they still do now, was that the one thing that radiated from your mum was how much she cared for you. You were her life. So I have some really fond memories, even when she was drinking, of her. And there was just that love. The mother and daughter love was there, but she was told, because she was 41 when she had me, so she was quite, in today's day and age, an older parent in a sense, but she was told she would never have children. So when eventually she fell pregnant, there was a protective side when I was born. So everybody still to this day says that she was just attached to you, to the point where my brothers have said to me, she wouldn't leave you alone. She was always there, constantly looking after you. And so that bond never broke, even during her time when she was drinking. But I think one of the things with the alcohol is just the actual experiences that made me grow up quite quickly that I had with her. But I would go into her house. She moved into a council house because social services got involved and said, look, Sarah can't live with Gabby anymore because of the drink, etc. If she doesn't move out, we'll take her into care, take Sarah into care. So she moved into a council house. And I remember walking in to a council house, which was just across the road. And her favourite song was Life is a Roller Coaster by Ronan Keating. And she had these huge speakers in the corner of her house. And even when she'd had a drink, and I actively knew she was drunk, sometimes she was in the mood where she just wanted, in a sense, to dance with her daughter. And she put this song on. And it was just, I still have those memories of just loving her a lot. But there were bad times, really bad times with her. And I think being 9 years old when she died, I look at 9 year olds now and I just think they're still kids. So I was still a kid, basically. How did I deal with everything in such a grown up way? But I think because I didn't want people to take her away from me, because it felt like my dad was taking her away from me, where if she went into rehab, they were taking my mother away. I accepted that for who she was. And I got on with it because I didn't want anybody to take away that mother that I had there. And actually more than often, and she was the best mum that you needed, you know? So there were difficult times. And I think actually in my interview with GB News, I talked more about the difficulties, but actually my memories of my mum are great as well, because I just know how much she loved me. And I still think to this day, because the house is just up the road from where I live now, we planted a rose garden, a little rose bush in there. And I've always wanted to just walk around the corner and see what's grown since we planted it as kids, do you know? So, yeah, I had great memories with her. I had tough memories, but I took it to be normal, which was the worst thing to happen, really. That was my normality because it had happened for so long.
Sarah, how aware were you, because you were so young, how aware were you of alcohol, the substance? How aware were you of drinking culture, the idea, the concept of being drunk?
So alcohol in general, I knew the effects that it had on my mum specifically. I was too young to understand the alcohol culture in general, but I could just see the negative effects that it had on her and the way that she then acted, the things that happened to her through what she was doing, which was drinking vodka. And so I was very aware of her situation, but not of the wider situation.
And in terms of, you know, being so young, how do you start to even process that when it's happening? You know, that you're seeing that your mom is drinking vodka. You understand that it's having negative effects on her.
You process it in a very direct manner, that you just want to deal with the situation that you've got in front of you. So I remember, for example, going over to her house, and if I opened the door and could tell that she'd had a drink, which was most days, unless she'd been in rehab, where she'd have a 6 week period where she hadn't, my first thought was, right, I'd walk in sometimes and she'd be shaking. And the reason that she was shaking was because she hadn't eaten and she drank. So from my perspective, it was going, I know where the vodka's hidden. It's behind her back on the sofa. She used to try and hide it from me there. And I remember I'd go in sometimes, I'd go and pour the vodka down the sink and I'd fill it with water. I wouldn't contact anybody else. This would be me dealing with it, because I've come to visit my mum. Or if she was shaking, I remember one time she was really shaking, and I asked her when was the last time she'd eaten, and she couldn't answer the question. So I opened the fridge and there was just yogurt in the fridge. So I got out the yogurt and I sat and spoon fed her, because I thought I'll feed her and she'll be better. So you you're very practical in that sense. So like I said, you look at 9-year-olds now and you think, how did I understand what to do there? And I can't really tell you how I did understand it, but I think everything it goes back to is I just wanted to be with my mum so I would fix the situation. And actually what I've learned in later life is I very much struggle now. If there is a situation in front of me, the first thing I want to do is fix it. And I'll look at all of the avenues to be able to do that. And so when you're stuck in a position where you can't fix it, I find that I really do struggle with that mentally, and it gets me down. So it was very practical with my mum. I wanted to stay with her. I wanted to be with her. People would take her away from me if they found out how bad she was. So I would fix it so that they wouldn't recognise how bad she was.
Which is why you didn't talk to anyone.
I talked to people when I needed to. When it was at the point where I thought that she needed an ambulance or something like that, I would run to a neighbour's house and they would come in and they would try and sort it out. There was I think she was a nurse that lived across the road who also had a daughter that I was friends with. So when I knew that this was beyond what I could sort, then I would go and seek the help, because I would never have put her in danger, in a sense, of being in a position where she didn't get the medical help that she needed. And that meant sometimes she ended up in hospital. But if I could fix it, and because I was so used to it, I would fix it there and then.
And everything you're saying to us now, you were 9 years old. We're not even talking like a teenager that's got more of an understanding of what's going on. You're 9 years old. You are a little girl. A lot of what we talk about on the podcast, it comes up a lot, parents that drink. I was one of them. And a couple of weeks ago, Sarah, Ben invited my daughter on this podcast, and I didn't know she was coming on. She's 20, so much older. And I stopped drinking 5 years ago. So for the first 15 years of her life, she obviously knew me as a drinker. And time again, we talk about, you know, what do your children notice? You know, is there a change in mood and behaviour and all the rest of it? And she said some things on the podcast about the way I changed when I'd had a drink, and they weren't positive. And she had every right to say it. Listening to what you're saying now at the age of 9, never mind 20, and the years leading up to that as an even younger child, you didn't miss anything. You knew exactly what was going on, and you went into almost protection mode, protecting yourself and where possible, trying to protect your mum.
Yeah, I did. And I don't know how I did it now, because people speak to me and they remind me how young I was when I dealt with it. And again, I go back to looking at the 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds and thinking, what was going on in my brain to be able to make sure that I was doing that? I can't understand it myself, Sharon. I'd love to be able to. But I grew up a lot quicker than I needed to. I recognise that. And actually, I think that's helped me in later life in a sense, but also I've missed out on what should have been a normal childhood, in a sense, where you don't have those worries and you don't have those wars. But I don't think I class them as worries and wars, because it was just normality to me.
Was it always normal? Do you ever remember a time where your mum didn't drink, or was that always the case, Sarah?
I remember when she came out of rehab and she wouldn't drink for periods of 6 weeks. But I think, and I might be slightly out on this, but I think when social services came, I was only around the age of 5 or 6 years old. So the memories prior to that, I remember what she used to do when she lived with my dad before social services got involved. And because of this protection that she had over me, and everybody knew it, she used to make the excuse of taking me to bed and she used to sleep with me. So we'd be up in the attic because she didn't want to leave me. That was the excuse. But she'd take alcohol upstairs and drink in the room. So she'd cuddle me to sleep, but then she'd sit up in this attic room and she'd drink the vodka then. So I don't really have any memories of her not being an alcoholic, not drinking, but not being an alcoholic. I have the memories of when she was sober, but they're very hazy and few and far between. But the alcohol for me didn't change her being my mum. She was, do you know, because I think I was so used to it. And I know my dad, and bless my dad, I was awful with him because I blamed him for taking her away. Everybody was against me. Everybody was taking mum away. And so I wasn't a great 5, 6, 7 year old with him because I just could not understand why everybody was stopping me having this relationship with her. And actually it was the dangers that surrounded it, because in the end, when she died, now it wasn't because she was drunk, she actually choked to death on a piece of meat that she was cooking, obviously drunk at the time. But then the fear from my father's side was always the house will set on fire, something will happen, so Sara cannot stay over at Gabby's house. And she choked to death on the piece of meat that came out in the post-mortem. But what happened was a chip pan set on fire. So actually the house did set on fire. The fear that my dad had of what could happen if I stayed in that house with my mum happened. So he was just doing everything he could to look after me. But I could never understand that.
Sara, you telling your story is hugely important. Thank you so much for doing it. I know we said that at the beginning. We'll undoubtedly say it again as we get to the end of this interview. It's so important because you're right, you are in a position of power. I do want to talk about society at large a bit later on, from your viewpoint, the chair that you sit. From the GB News interview, there's one thing I want to ask you about, which is, I think we can all agree, probably, that as a society, we need to help and support the individual to recover. But you also talk about the need to support families. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's working out how to support families. I'll be honest with you. Since the GB News interview, I actually had to just take a step back because I opened up again about something that was very difficult for me to open up about. It felt like a therapy session, but with cameras on you. How we support families is a really difficult question, but I think actually that again goes back to the point of the support that's needed for the person who comes out of rehab, because the family then is seen as a support mechanism. Well, it was back when it happened with my mum, but actually we don't know the answers. I was a young child being told that I could fix it. I could fix my mum, the reason that she would stop drinking. And it wasn't by anybody in the medical profession. It was the people surrounding me that said, we can tell how much she loves you. The only way that she'll stop drinking is because of you.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
But they weren't doing it in a malicious sense.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to more of an understanding of being an alcoholic is an illness. And I've said this before. And it's not a simple fix. People can't just put the bottle down. Do you know, it's a really difficult process for anybody to go to. It's more of a national understanding about that and awareness of it. But support for the families, I think, for me, I don't even know what support I could have had, because the support I wanted was from the person that was drinking.
Yeah.
So the only way for the support for the families to work was to be able to support the person who was doing it, to, in a sense, be fixed, to stop. So I think the only way to support families is for them to understand, and children, that it's not their fault and that the pressure can't be on them to fix it. But the support needs to be in place for the person who is drinking to be able to stop. Because you're never going to stop a child from wanting to be with their parents, no matter what they do. And every support mechanism you put around them, their first thought will be, that's my parent who loves me. And I know there are some relationships with alcohol that make people abusive, etc. But if they're not in that situation, the only support that you can give that child is by stopping their parent from drinking.
We're just going to take a quick break from this chat with our guest this week, Sarah Brickcliffe. More from Sarah very, very shortly. It's this time of the month again that we get quite excited, don't we, Ben? Not, hang on a minute. I'm a menopausal woman talking about the time of the month.
Okay.
Should we clarify what I mean?
Where are we going? This is a gear change. Yeah.
This is Friday Triday. It's just around the corner.
It's a Friday Triday.
That's the one.
Yes, because it's the first Friday of the month this Friday. Yes, it's a Friday Triday with Over the Influence. And what that means is that if you've been listening to this podcast and you're thinking, you know what, this community does sound quite good, actually. You know, you hear the little bits at the beginning, our members going, I love Over the Influence for this reason, and this reason. You're going, you know what, they sound like really normal, nice people that I'd like to get to know and meet. Yes, you can just join if you want to by going to overtheinfluence.co.uk. But we also know that some people might want to try before you buy, which is why we do a Triday Friday with Over the Influence. overtheinfluence.co.uk/Triday. You can sign up, and it's me in the morning at 8 o'clock UK time. It's Shazza in the evening at 6 p.m. UK time.
6 p.m. UK time. And just jump on for 5 minutes, jump on for half an hour, however you want to use the time. It's completely up to you. And you know what? I've had...
But it's about basically... Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, I've had like a 100% success rate with those Friday Tri-Days. It's been amazing. It's been really good because I think in the main, it's people teetering on the brink, which, again, it just sounds all completely wrong. But teetering with the idea of joining a community, and it might just, you know, you're thinking, oh, it's going to be a bit odd. Is it really, does this mean I've got a problem? No. It just means you might want to connect with like-minded individuals. And every single chat I've had on a Friday Triday has just been wonderful. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If you are one of the people that joined those Tridays last time and have since joined the community, it's absolutely brilliant to have you as part of it. It really, really is. And as Ben said there, we can just answer any of your questions. We can let you know how the Zoom calls run, what you get out of the community in terms of, you know, the forums and the chat and all that. And then you might want to join us on some of the OTI adventures for next year, not yet planned, in the process of overtheinfluence.co.uk/Triday. Just go up at the end there for Friday Triday. Doesn't sound as good when I do it.
I think it sounded great. overtheinfluence.co.uk/Triday. And we'll see you on this Friday Triday with Over the Influence.
Ben, thank you very, very much. Let's get back to the chat with Sarah. It's coming up for 20 years, isn't it, Sarah, since you lost your mum. Have you seen any changes over the last 20 years in terms of support and the way people are treated that would class themselves as alcoholic? You've got the stigma, you've got the shame. My auntie died of alcoholism, I think it's less than 20 years ago, and she died alone, and there was no help, and there was no real sober communities. Yes, you had AA, and that was about it. And so often we hear of stories of people just terrified of putting their hands up for help because of the shame and stigma that comes with it. Oh, look at that. Oh, another alcoholic. They brought it on themselves. And this labelling, we're hoping and praying that these days it has changed. But what's your experience been?
So I do think that it has changed, because I do think that we have more people who are opening up to say that they've struggled with alcohol. And so I think the fact that we are seeing that is a huge positive. You do still get the narrow-minded people, we always will, who will say, oh, he's just an alcoholic. Not that there's an issue behind that person that needs fixing. Not that there's a breakdown in a family that's turned them to drink. Not that they've got mental health problems, so they use a bottle to be able to sleep at night. There will always be those narrow-minded people. But I do think that actually we are seeing more and more people speak up to say that actually there's a fundamental issue behind why somebody drinks. Usually it's to shut something out. Usually it's to sleep. Usually it's to forget and do it. It's whether I don't know, someone's in a stressful job and they can't switch off, they'll drink, do you know? So I do think that we've seen an increase in people speaking up, and actually on a national level, I think that's been highlighted much more, and the stigma is dying down on it. Like I said, it doesn't matter whether we're 20 years on or another 20 years on, there will always be narrow-minded people that can't understand that this is a problem. But I do think, and it goes down to a lot of people speaking about it, and that comes down to my decision to speak about it as well, because more people are speaking up about the effects that it has on them, the effects that it has on the parents, brothers, sisters, families. And so I think it's down to those people that have spoken about it that we are seeing these changes.
Okay. I'd like to talk to MP Sarah for a second about this kind of wider societal narrative, because so the reason I just smiled then is because Sarah, you went, oh,
she rolled her eyes. Okay, she rolled her eyes at you then, Ben.
Don't worry, I'm not going to grill you, Sarah, I promise. I think what I'd like to talk about is that wider societal narrative. And you know, you say there are people out there who are small-minded, who are they just an alcoholic. This is part of a bigger problem though, isn't it? And it's, for example, phrases like drink responsibly, I don't personally think help in particular, because what the phrase drink responsibly says to me is that it puts the blame, I suppose, on the person rather than the substance. This is a highly addictive poison, essentially, which is neatly packaged and readily available and aggressively marketed to us at almost every turn. But oh, you can drink responsibly. We did tell you to drink responsibly, but you didn't do that. You're an alcoholic. But the vast majority of the population aren't, but you are. Do you get where I'm coming from here? Like, it's hugely important that you tell us your story. I'm just thinking of some of your other colleagues who've been in the headlines recently. Under a different banner, but Dan Carden MP, for example, down the road from me here in Liverpool, he's been speaking about this. It's really important that people do speak up, but can we ever, are there going to be enough people to do it, to change that wider societal narrative where the blame is put on the person and not the substance?
I think it's a really difficult narrative to change, to be honest. And I would love to say, yes, we can change that narrative overnight. I think because, I mean, we are in a culture where, for example, if I go out with my friends, the first thing is, let's go for drinks, let's go for cocktails. Do you know, there is always that drink involved. And I don't think people understand how highly addictive alcohol is, the dangers of it. I think the drink responsibly slogan, I think you're right, actually. I don't see what it does. I don't see how it helps. I can't think how we can change this culture that we live in now, where to go out and enjoy yourselves, especially young people, is to go out and have a drink. That's why I want to talk to the organisations that I'm planning to speak to as to what they believe we can do to change that narrative. Because while some politicians pretend they know everything, I don't know the answers to this. And that's why since the GB News interview, I'm setting up meetings to be able to discuss what they think and what we do. Because obviously we look at the rates, etc., the pricing of alcohol. I understand that, but then I also go back to the fact of that if my mum needed alcohol, she would beg, borrow and steal to get the alcohol. Do you know, it didn't matter how much it costed, she would get that when she needed it. So I understand the push there, but no, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer as to whether we can change society's perception on alcohol. But also I can't be then in a position to say this, because I have to admit, do I go out for drinks? I know obviously this is about sobriety, but from a personal perspective, I do go out and I'll have drinks with friends and on social occasions. But I also have the fear in my head of every time that I have the drink, whether that's a glass of wine, etc., of am I going to end up like my mum? Am I drinking too much? And so the fear is always there for me of, oh gosh, am I becoming addicted to this? Am I using it as a crutch? And so I always have that in the back of my mind. And sometimes I do worry that if I have too much drink, my instant thought is, I'm addicted to alcohol. I'm like my mum. Everybody expected it, you know. But I don't know. I don't know the answer. It's difficult.
So just to kind of let you know our perspective on it, we do not judge drinkers. We have chosen to be alcohol free ourselves because it works better for us. For me personally, this podcast started as a job, and it came into my life at a time where it actually shone a spotlight on my own drinking that I'd never thought about before, because in inverted commas, it was normal. You know, I looked around peers, what society was doing, and my drinking was normal. I was a binge drinker. I wouldn't drink every day, but I'd go out on the weekend and I'd really put them away. It wasn't healthy, and I'd started to drink more because I was stressed, not because it was fun and enhancing the good times that I was having. I was drinking because I was stressed. And I think what we try and do here at Over the Influence, we're all about early intervention, essentially. One of the phrases that we always come back to was said by a man that we call Wise Tim on one of our very first ever Zoom calls. And he said, I didn't have a rock bottom, but I could see it from where I was standing. And for me, that resonated. Or Billy Connolly, I stopped drinking while it was still my idea. For us, God, can I do one more quote?
Go on, chuck another one in. Sorry, he's got a quote board.
I've got a quotes board here.
He could be here for hours.
Although, I'm not looking at them. I'm just reading them off because I do talk about them quite a lot. It was Desmond Tutu when he died a few years ago. Lots of his quotes are going around Facebook and whatever. And it was my favourite one. You've got to stop pulling people out the river and go upstream and find out why they're falling in. For us, early intervention, we don't judge drinkers. We don't say that you shouldn't drink and that everybody should give up completely. For us, it worked. I think for us, it's about education, and it's about trying to promote self-awareness in terms of, for me, it was that kind of self-awareness of, actually, this isn't improving. This is a slippery slope that I'm currently on. I don't want to get to the bottom of that slope and see what happens there. So I removed alcohol completely. I think, do you think that, for example, the Irish government are going to be putting alcohol warning labels on alcohol from 2025, I believe. The French government, there's a law in France that you can't advertise alcohol at sporting or cultural events. To me, that's the government saying alcohol is a potentially dangerous substance. That's something that the government is doing. It's not on the individuals to tell their stories and to try and reshape that narrative. It is the government saying, these are the things that we put in place to try and educate society that this is a potentially dangerous substance. Do you think, not as Sarah, who I hope is our new friend of the podcast, but as Sarah MP, do you think that we do enough, the government does enough to say this is a potentially very dangerous, not for everybody, but it is a potentially very dangerous substance, and we need to have that kind of level of awareness around it that may not exist today?
I think it's I'm giving you a politician's answer here. I think it's a very difficult question to answer, because I do think that there is already the underlying knowledge that alcohol can be dangerous. And so these, in a sense, I agree with the warning signs potentially on the substance, on alcohol, but cultural events, etc., I don't think it would make a difference, because people are either going and they're already drinking at that event and they know that they're going to have a drink, or they're not going and that's not going to influence their decision on whether they're going to have a drink or not. Do you see what I'm trying to say, in a sense? So I think that everybody does already have the knowledge. I mean, when you're growing up, your parents might say, you can try a sip of this wine at 14 years old. And that's already, in essence, your parents saying, there's a reason we're not letting you drink it, because it's dangerous. So I think as a culture, we already know the dangers of it. When we talk about early intervention, it comes back to alcohol being a crutch for some reason or another. The early intervention, from what I believe, has to be understanding what is driving people to have to pick up that drink to block out whatever's going on in their life. And so that can be a whole load of things. I know that at some periods when I've really struggled in this job, the pandemic, etc., when you're on your own, the pressure's there. Some nights I would have gone and I'd picked up a bottle of wine because I just couldn't deal with the work-life balance. I needed to switch off. So I think the early intervention has to be establishing why that person is drinking in the first place. Yes, have the national awareness that drinking can lead to some devastating impacts, but the early intervention needs to be more focused on why that person is drinking in the first place and how do we fix that problem, not the alcohol. Because once they start to feel better in their lifestyle, they won't be using alcohol as a crutch.
I promise that's the end of any sort of political question from me.
He had to go there.
Thank you for indulging me. So, but you know what? We've got thousands of listeners across the world. We've got a really engaged and dedicated community of people in our online community where these kind of things are talked about. And it's not very often that we get the opportunity to speak to somebody
you can change.
Like you. But thank you for it. And I promise, Sharon, no more politics for me.
You'll not get politics off me, Sarah. You absolutely won't. Talking very briefly about politics, actually. It's easy to forget how young you are and how young you still are. You know, we've talked a lot about...
Don't feel it, Sharon.
Well, you might not feel it, but you look it. And you are it, Sarah. So 9 years old when you lost your mum. I mean, for any child to lose a parent at such a young age, never mind the circumstances that you had to deal with. Do you mind if we just talk a little bit about the impact on you as a teenager and then as a young woman? Because my point was about politics. 2019, you were the youngest ever Conservative MP when elected. Age of 24, so you're only, I'm rubbish at maths, 28, have I got that right now?
28, yes. 28 going on 48, it feels like, with this job. Yeah.
So you are still, you know, in the grand scheme of life, you are still so young, but you've had to deal with such really heavy stuff, haven't you, as a child and then as a young woman. How's that been? Without wanting to sound like a really stupid question, because it's obvious it's difficult.
Well, so it really, I think because I was that young, it was just the feeling of when she died, of her not being there. There was no other emotions of my mum's gone. That was it. Your friends were going out with their mum's shopping. It was that kind of feeling. But actually, I don't think emotionally and mentally it hit me. And I said this on the GB News interview until I moved to university. Because I was isolated then. It was me on my own facing the world. And that's when my mental health really took a turn for the worst. I ended up on antidepressants, felt suicidal, I'll be honest. Failed my first year of university because I didn't want to leave the halls. I just didn't want to do anything. Got myself into a horrible place. Became a person I never expected myself to be. But it was because I'd left the safety of my family, the safety of those people who had in a sense, been a mother to me that I needed locally. And actually, that was probably the worst period for me. So it has had an impact on my life hugely. And still to this day, I mean, the first thing I thought when I won the general election would be, I would love nothing more than to see my mum stood there. Do you know, things like that. So the big moments in your life where you just want to see that person looking back at you and going, well done, you did it. Do you know? And yet you're staring at a gravestone, in a sense. So yeah, it does, like you can tell, yeah, I'm tearing up a little bit. But yeah, it still impacts me. And I still suffer with anxiety. I have still got this mindset of when I can't fix something, I struggle with it. And I suppose being an MP, most of the job is fix it. Work out how you fix this situation. It's the same with constituents casework. It's the same with what you want to do for your area. There is always a route to fix it. So my brain gets a bit stuck when I can't work out how to fix it. And so they always say that you never stop grieving, but it becomes easier. And that is true. You never forget about the person. It just becomes easier to live with. And 20 years on, I know how much I still, and like you can tell from the emotions that I'm showing, I wish that she was here, but I still know that that love is there. She will always be my mum. And regardless of how long time passes, I think if I have a child, the emotion will be there of, I wish she had a grandmother, do you know, she, he. I'm judging something there. I'm not pregnant before or anything like that. So. but that my child, I would have loved her to meet my mother, do you know? So you learn to live with it, but you also have all of these things in the back of your head. And I also worry about the rest of my family, especially the family that's related to my mother, because I do worry about their drinking habits as well. And not something that I am going to share on this, but there is a fear there of me living through what I went through with my mum again, and whether I'm a strong enough person to have to deal with it again, or whether that would set me back in my mind 10, 20 years and bring up scars that I don't want to bring up again.
How are you feeling, Sarah?
All right. Getting used to talking about it, getting used to realising, especially from the response that I received after the interview, that it's not just me that has lived this. Because when you're living through it, when you're dealing with the emotions of after someone's passed away, you do feel like it's just you. You feel a bit of sympathy for yourself as, I shouldn't have gone through this, but actually there are other people that experience this. And again, it comes back to the reason that I'm sat here tonight talking to you, why I did the interview, because there are so many people that are questioning what to do, how they do it, how do they fix it, because people are telling them that. And actually, it's not an easy answer. Nobody has an easy solution for that.
Leads on to my next question, actually, because I want to know, what's next for you in life? Personally, professionally, you're 28. My God, you know, you've achieved so much already. What are your plans?
There's a general election potentially at some point next year. So my...
And when are you thinking that might be?
Oh, I'm dead. I have absolutely no idea, Ben.
Okay.
Stop it, Ben.
Just checking.
Stop
just thought. Sorry.
Like I said, I was 24 when I got into this job. I think if somebody had told me back in 2019, by the way, Sarah, you're 24 years old, there's an international pandemic, a war in Ukraine, cost of living, I'd have gone, you're all right, good luck to whoever takes on that job. But there's been huge changes across time, but hasn't, in like funding wise, etc. So even if I lose a general election next time, I know I can come home, and when I've seen that happened, I can turn around and go, I did something, and I achieved something for my family, for my friends, for my home. So my plan is to fight the general election on the work that I've done. And if I lose, I lose, and I go off, and I'm 29 years old. The world's my oyster. I'm still young. But right now, my focus is on hoping, even with the national polls in the position that they are in currently, retaining my seat and being able to just carry on and seeing, actually, whilst we've got the funding now, the shovels aren't in the ground. So you can't see what you've achieved. So I want to be able to be in this position to be able to see the achievements that I've made and seeing how it's changed people's lives for the better. And like I said, regardless of political colour, I do think that every politician comes into this job to be able to do that. They just have different views as to how to achieve it.
Amazing. Shaz, I know that you've got two final questions.
Two more questions.
For Sarah.
I've got two more questions to squeeze in.
And we haven't got loads of time.
No, we haven't. Sarah, it's gone so, so fast. And thank you for, I know Ben said it in the middle, we said it at the beginning, and we'll say it again at the end. Thank you so much for just chatting so candidly and so honestly about everything. It's hugely appreciated. And there's a reason we wanted to talk to you. You know, there's a reason we wanted you to share your story. For people listening to this, be it a parent that is still drinking, be it, and I say a child of a drinker, I can't imagine there's anybody listening to this that is the age that, that you were, but we're all children of somebody, regardless of age. What do you want them to take away from your story and what you experienced?
So, Sharon, that's a really, really difficult one for me to answer without saying snap out of it, because that's what I wanted to tell my mum. And I know now it's not as simple. But if you are a parent and there is a child at the end, you might not realise it, but that child is absolutely terrified of losing their parent through this. And it happens. So it's not for the child to fix it. It's for you to fix yourself for the child. It's for you to stop to know that you will continue to have the relationship that you want with your child. So it's more aimed for me at those who do have children and maybe don't understand the impacts that it's having on their child, and hoping that in a sense it makes them realise that actually whilst the child might be a very young child, the thoughts in the head are everything that I've just said previously, and they are wanting to fix their parents. So get the help that you need to fix it so that you can be there with your kid for a lot longer than my mum was with me.
And Sarah, finally, how do you want to remember your mum, Gabby?
Oh, it goes back to that Life is a Roller Coaster song. I just remember her in a big fur coat that I think my dad got her for Christmas once, dancing around, and I have never seen somebody as happy to just be dancing with their daughter around the living room to the favourite song. And that will always be my favourite memory of my mum.
Sarah, thank you.
No, thank you. Thanks.
Huge thanks to Sarah Brickcliffe MP for joining us on Over the Influence and just sharing so honestly about her story. We said it at the beginning, we said it during the course of the chat, and we've said it at the end, and we'll say it again. Sarah, thank you. Hugely, hugely appreciated.
Isn't it mad that we just had an actual Member of Parliament on the podcast?
Yeah.
Like, is that just completely, isn't that just bonkers, an actual MP?
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I see where you're coming from with that. I understand. But at the same time, I think we've been doing this long enough now and spoken to so many people to know that regardless of who you are and what you do and your background and your position in life, whatever it might be, there's a potential for alcohol to impact anybody's life in a negative way. And I just know that by talking to Sarah this week on the podcast and Sarah sharing her story, what it was like, you know, being the daughter of somebody that was addicted to alcohol, it will help other people, undoubtedly. It really, really will. So again, thank you for sharing your story, Sarah.
Right. Shazza, before we go, we've got to mention, we mentioned it in the middle, but we're going to mention it again. If you fancy joining us on Zoom this week, it's a Friday try day with Over the Influence. Oh, yes. We don't have to tell you all about it again. You've heard it once already, but we'll just read out that website address, overtheinfluence.co.uk/try day. That's overtheinfluence.co.uk/try day, because it's a Friday try day. If you'd like to come and give it a go, just go and go to that address. Just click sign up and you'll get an email with the Zoom link on it and everything else, and then we'll see you on Friday and it'll be great. Come and join us, it'll be fun.
Need to add there as well, I don't think we said this in the middle bit of the episode, it's absolutely free, won't cost you a penny. Just come and have a chat to Ben at 8 o'clock in the morning. This is UK time, 8 a.m. BST. We'll be needing to change that, won't we, when the clocks go back and it all starts going chaotic again with regard to the world clocks. Let's not.
I don't want to talk about that at the moment.
No.
Not in the headspace to be able to think about time zones right now, because it's not that all the time zones in the whole world change on the same date.
Leave it.
In Australia, they change on a date, and then in America, they change on a different date, and we change on a different date. And then in Australia, some states go by an hour, some states do it half an hour. Sharon, we haven't got time to do this now.
Right, forget just forget everything we've said about time zones. Basically, so these calls are happening this coming Friday, 8 o'clock in the morning, UK time, okay? 8 a.m. UK time with lovely Ben. And if that doesn't fit in with your day, not a problem. You can jump on with me at 6 p.m. UK time. In fact, if you want to chat to Ben and me, double bubble for free. Talk to us both. We're here to answer all your questions about the fabulous Over the Influence community. overtheinfluence.co.uk/Triday. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back at the same time next week.